Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington policymakers, DC insiders, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. This AI revolution has been led by industry, and governments are running to catch up. Lucky for us, today's guest is Christopher Kirchhoff, co-author of Unit X. He is one of the trailblazing co-founders of the Defense Innovation Unit X, or now called DIU, the Pentagon's first permanent advanced tech outpost based in Silicon Valley. DIU was founded to tackle one of our most pressing challenges, bridging the gap between the rapid pace of private sector tech innovation and the critical needs of the Department of Defense. Titled Unit X, How the Pentagon and Silicon Valley are Transforming the Future of War, it's must read. If you don't believe me, believe the FT. Christopher, you and your co-author Ross Shaw did the impossible. You created a defense unit within the Pentagon. I don't know how you did it. We're going to talk about all that. And I also want to talk about the Trump administration, the incoming Pentagon folks, Pentagon Priorities Now, where you're consulting, the AI companies, your role at Anthropic, the people, the places, the Elon Musk of it all. But first, let's talk about Unit X. How did you do it? And how did you get picked for that job?
Well, thanks, Tammy. It's great to be with you. Your career in Washington, you never know where it's going to go, right? A lot of my work as a young aide in the Pentagon was on commercial technology. And this is at a time back in 2015, 2016, when Google was rolling out their self-driving car. Many things in Silicon Valley were actually more advanced than the technology the Pentagon was using. And so people got really curious about it. At a certain point, the Pentagon decided to set up a kind of embassy in Silicon Valley to explore that world of commercial technology and see what of it might be relevant to military missions.
And how did they pick you?
Well, Ash Carter literally told me I would be moving to California. And this was a problem because I had five pairs of suits and one pair of jeans, and I needed the opposite for Silicon Valley. And so in 2016, my co-author, Rod Shaw, and I came to helm Defense Innovation Unit, this newly created outpost whose mission was to work with startups, work with technology companies that maybe had never before sold their technology to the military.
Was there a lot of resistance? Because today in Washington, and we'll get to it, you've got VC startups just clamoring to be part of the AI ecosystem here, especially on the defense side.
It really was a different time, and it's important to rewind the tape and notice what was happening at the moment. In 2016, there wasn't a single venture capitalist that was willing to back a startup that would want to develop technology for the Department of Defense. Why? Well, it turns out the Department of Defense is an awful, atrocious customer when it comes to buying technology. The I'm here from the government to help, right, is not a line that goes over well, especially when it comes to the request to fill out thousands of pages of paperwork, request to set up a whole separate system of financial accounting that could be auditable by defense standards, and also the news that it might take 2 years to negotiate a contract. And even if you win the first contract, you might have a better positioned defense company with better lobbyists swoop in and grab the second bigger contract. So that is not an attractive value proposition for venture capitalists that are looking for their startups to show profitability inside of a year or year and a half as they're raising their next funding rounds.
The story you tell in this book, it definitely should be a TV movie or a series of how you struggled to take what you needed to get from the Pentagon to build these offices. And I wonder, how did the industry react first when there you were in the first building you described? What did you have, like three tables or something?
Yeah, the furniture was a little rough. It turns out the Pentagon is not very good at setting up an office 3,000 miles away outside of it. So the office originally was set up in the vacant arm of a National Guard armory at a really cool place called Moffett Field, a formal naval air station named actually for Admiral Moffett, who is a really important figure in military history. He's the person that figured out that it would be aircraft carriers and not battleships that would win the next war. So he was an incredible military innovator who, had he not been experimenting with aviation technology on the West Coast in the interwar periods, World War II literally would have you know, gone differently. World history would be different. So it was an amazing place to be, right across the fence from Google. But right away, we faced a challenge, which is to get Silicon Valley startups and tech firms to even talk to us.
And what was the key to turning that around?
Well, the key was we had to figure out a way to be able to contract for their technology in less than, say, 2 years. And the solution came through an incredible story of what one woman named Lauren Daly was able to achieve. Lauren is an Army acquisition executive. She was 29 years old at the time. And she stayed up late at night reading the National Defense Authorization Act, this 1,000-page bill passed by the Congress every year. And in Section 813 of the 2017 NDAA, she spots a single line that was snuck in there by a renegade staffer of Senator McCain, and realizes that it's a loophole you can drive a truck through to buy technology faster. And so Lauren and I quickly fly back to the Pentagon, and with then Secretary of Defense's Ash Carter's support, get the Pentagon to codify a whole new way of buying technology quickly on commercial terms in a way that Silicon Valley startups engage with.
And who was the first startup, if you can say, that you worked with?
Yeah, we did 10 contracts in rapid fire. And one of them that's still going today, it's a really incredible story. It's a company called Joby, which at the time was in stealth. So nobody knew about it, but one of our guys knew about it. And Joby is building and has built a flying car. It's a VTOL aircraft powered by batteries, flies almost silently, has AI and autonomous capabilities. And compared to a helicopter, it has a heck of a lot of benefits for the military. So we were able to come back and say, hey, it's not just cybersecurity software that we're finding out here. We're actually finding flying cars that might be useful for U.S. Special Forces.
Did they laugh when you first said, hey, I want to introduce you to Joby. They've got flying cars?
No, actually, U.S. Special Forces Command sent an enormous amount of personnel to a quiet military test range not too far from Silicon Valley and immediately began evaluating the prototype aircraft to see whether it might be something they could use. And today, Joby is flying with the U.S. Air Force.
That's fantastic. I wonder how you talk about the generals, the admirals, the leadership of the military. Did they want certain things when they found out about you? Did they say, we're looking for flying cars or other things? Was there a checklist? We're missing this from the Army. The Navy is looking for this. The Air Force is looking for that. Or did you come to them with companies like Joby?
Well, the thing to remember is at that time, for years and years, all the best technology in the world was created inside government labs like DARPA, which invented the internet and stealth technology and GPS. But that started to change at the end of the Cold War. And this is the important point, a real point of inflection. Essentially, federal research and development flatlined at a time when the commercial sector just exploded. So fast forward to 2015, 2016, we have these enormous tech companies, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, any one of which has a market capitalization larger than the entire defense industry combined. The Pentagon is just used to, for years and years, dealing with a very small number of defense-specific firms. And that worked out at a moment when those firms unquestionably had the best technology. But if you have many more engineers working in the commercial sector, the locus of innovation has shifted. And so the critical thing about Defense Innovation Unit was to access that whole other pool of innovation that the Pentagon and all the generals in it were essentially blind to.
And were you funding these companies, or were you just offering them, we'll do a pilot program and try out your technology?
We were buying their products to pilot. And because of this amazing new acquisition authority named the CSO, if we were to find a technology that worked, that performed well, anybody in the Department of Defense could then buy it at scale. Mm-hmm. And this was the game changer. So if you're in Silicon Valley and you have one self-driving car, or one drone, and it performs well on a pilot. Now, all of a sudden, the Army or the Navy or the Air Force can buy 10,000 of them. And this was an incredibly important change in Silicon Valley, because for the first time, it meant that investors were willing to back companies that were building products for the Department of Defense. So in 2015, 2016, venture investors would actually discourage their companies from taking meetings with Defense Innovation Unit. Fast forward 5 or 6 years, there's now over $200 billion of venture capital funding backing young, innovative defense companies that are completely changing the kind of technology the Pentagon has access to.
And what do you see right now, that $200 billion, where's the best money spent since you're so up close? What do you think the biggest opportunity is?
Right now, technology, as we all know, is changing really rapidly, particularly with artificial intelligence, also with autonomy. And so these firms are the closest, far closer than the traditional firms, to the revolution in artificial intelligence. And they're able, because frankly, they bring much more modern ways of coding and building products to the fore, they're able to build technology faster, generally at a lower cost, and oftentimes much more effectively than the traditional defense firms. And so new defense tech firms like Anduril, like Shield AI, really are changing the game.
Are you saying that the majors, as they call them in DC, Lockheed Martin, et cetera, that they just couldn't pivot faster, that they didn't see it, they didn't have the right technologists, they were making too much money? Was there a way for them to step into this part of it? Because it just seems like there's so much money involved that they would try to pivot as well.
They're shackled to a way of building technology that is outmoded. I'll give you one example. On the cover of our book, Unit X, there is an F-35 fighter on top of an iPhone. Two incredible pieces of technology. The F-35 is a fifth generation stealth fighter, unquestionably the best in the world. However, its design was finalized in the late 1990s. The production contract for the F-35 was let in 2001. It didn't become operational until 2016. So as the F-35 is rolling down the runway in 2016, its processor, the GPU inside of it, is now 100 times slower than the processor in the iPhone 7 released that same year, because the commercial way of producing technology is much quicker. It iterates every year, it upgrades, it's able to take advances in technology and immediately incorporate them in products. So these are essentially two completely different systems of building technology, one old, one new.
In the last 2 weeks, Meta announced that they're going to start selling to defense tech. They're open source on the AI front. What's your reaction to that?
Artificial intelligence is amazing technology, whether it's improving Siri on your iPhone or image recognition or all the other things that it's doing. And it's not a surprise that this technology could also play a role in military missions. And so I think it's fantastic that different artificial intelligence firms are willing to step forward and begin seeing what applicability their products might have in all different parts of the Department of Defense.
I want to turn to China. This weekend, Eric Schmidt was on Fareed Zakaria's show, and I'm going to quote him here. He said, quote, 2 years ago, I told you here that we had a 2-year advantage against China. It looks like it's over. China has now released 3 models in the last month. They all have the same opportunity and power that the American models have. How did this happen? Do you want to react to that? And do you agree?
Yeah, first of all, China has been for years really focused on building up its research and development and tech sector. In fact, if you look at the amount of money in R&D that China has spent, it's gone up by several orders of magnitude to the point, with purchasing power going further in China, that China today is spending about 88% of what the U.S. does on R&D and on its military. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, with all the incredible technologists in China and their incredible manufacturing base, which is much stronger than ours, that they are emerging as a real competitor.
Mm-hmm. Is there any specific technology that you're seeing out of China that's not happening in the U.S. that's worth talking about?
China is a leader, particularly in drone technology. The Chinese company DJI, which offers drones that many of us use in our lives to make recordings, are incredibly sophisticated. And so for years now, DJI drones have also been showing up on the battlefield in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Iraq, now in the Middle East. In fact, Hamas was able to prosecute their incredibly successful attack of Israel on the 7th of October by using DJI drones. They attached charges to DJI drones. They flew them over the Israeli border wall that separated Israel and Gaza, and they dropped them onto communication towers, onto the automatic machine guns, and in a hurry were coming over the barrier. So it's a stunning illustration of how Chinese drones were used to defeat the Israeli military, one of the most advanced militaries in the world. And the same thing is actually happening today in Ukraine at an even larger scale.
Ukraine has drones, but not that sophisticated, correct?
Well, Ukrainian companies are coming up with drones of all kinds, many of which are actually more sophisticated than DJI drones because they're custom built for particular missions to fight in a battle where the Russians and the Ukrainians are using a lot of electronic countermeasures. So this really is an EW war, as a military analyst would call it. Each side is seeking ways to have artificial intelligence make their drones smart and be able to pierce through the electronic warfare of the other side to achieve effects of all kinds on the battlefield.
There have been reports from Israeli soldiers that they're using AI to select bomb targets. And some reports say that AI chose the targets. Do you know how that's working?
I'm not familiar with the system that the Israelis apparently are using. There's many media reports on it, but it shouldn't surprise us that artificial intelligence is involved in the long chain of analysis that comprises modern targeting. Artificial intelligence is oftentimes very good at identifying weak signals that might matter, that might be correlated with something that a human analyst would never catch. And so in the same way that a Tesla driving down the road uses AI to see an obstacle that it wants to avoid, you're going to see AI used increasingly in kinetic targeting by all kinds of militaries.
Is there any human in the loop? The reporting was Israeli soldiers said that they definitely had humans in the loop, but there's automation bias. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So today, the Department of Defense has a policy that says, where possible, have a man in the loop in all lethal targeting decisions, which is, of course, a good idea because you want to have direct supervision of systems that are operating on the battlefield. But autonomy, even quite exquisite examples of autonomy, have been around for a long time. In the 1970s, we started flying the Tomahawk cruise missile, which has the ability through machine learning to recognize different targets and to fly autonomously and select them without a human being actually in the loop. Similarly, our Aegis defense system on our Navy battleships and cruisers has the ability to automatically engage incoming threats, because oftentimes in the context of, say, a missile attack, a human analyst can't react as quickly as a computer can. So there are already shades of automation in how the U.S. military does targeting. And artificial intelligence is going to, of course, accelerate this further.
Can you talk about hypersonic weapons?
Yeah, hypersonic weapons are not our friends. The problem with hypersonic weapons is they fly much faster than intercontinental ballistic missiles. And not only that, but they maneuver. So unlike an ICBM, which follows a ballistic trajectory, so once it launches, you kind of know where it's going. By the way, once an ICBM launches, we have some fairly high-end missile defense systems that have a good shot of firing an interceptor to knock it out of the sky. A hypersonic weapon is not only faster, but because it can steer, unfortunately, today we have no known defenses against a hypersonic weapon. So the reality is that the American president, an American aircraft carrier, an American military base is a sitting duck until we do develop those measures.
And who else is leading on hypersonic?
Well, hypersonic weapons are still something in the research and development phase. Nobody has an operational hypersonic weapon. It's an incredible challenge to get a piece of titanium to fly at 10 times the speed of sound under control for periods of time before the vehicle itself burns up. But the first nation that can figure out how to do this at scale, and it will likely be China, is going to really, as the last chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Milley, called it, create a Sputnik moment, something that is going to change the game for deployed U.S. military forces. And for those of us that watch Innovation, it's a very uncomfortable moment, because we know that if hypersonic weapons do begin to work, even a small number of them, say 50 or 100, all of a sudden, aircraft carriers, Navy surface vessels, a lot of the big platforms that we've invested in are no longer going to be able to fight in the way that they were designed to. They're going to be newly vulnerable, and that's going to pose an enormous operational challenge to our military.
Okay, let's turn to the incoming Trump administration. There is a potential Secretary of Defense, but let's talk about in the larger picture, what do you think their priorities should be?
Well, there's an incoming administration at a moment of incredible change in how war is being fought. And so just look at Ukraine. So Ukraine is increasingly deploying the most sophisticated American weapons we have. And just to name one example, we gave Ukraine 31 M1 A1 Abrams battle tanks, the most advanced battle tank in the world. And in short order, in the last few months, the Russians have figured out how to engineer kamikaze drones. And today, more than half of those M1 A1 tanks have been taken off the battlefield by inexpensive Russian drone strikes. So that tells a new incoming administration that if you're running a military that's built with a lot of tanks, you now are behind the power curve, and you need to find new ways of experimenting with new weapons platforms to be able to compete. So there's an enormous change in the environment that the new administration is confronting.
What about Project 2025? We hear about that on the political side, but what about the defense platform there?
Well, there are two parts to Project 2025 when it concerns the military and national security. There's an agenda around the military's people and cultural issues, but also importantly, there is a technology agenda there. There's a recognition in the Project 2025 text that was written by a defense analyst that the United States military needs to quite quickly change what it's investing in, that more investment is needed in artificial intelligence, in commercial space technology, in missile defense, and some of the things that right now, today, places like Ukraine and the conflict in the Middle East are showing are badly needed.
And do you think these are good ideas?
Well, they're good ideas. And they're ideas also that the present administration, the Biden administration, is pursuing. For example, about 2 years ago, the Biden administration started the Replicator Initiative, which is designed to accelerate the production of autonomous systems, essentially drone swarms. But if you look at the Replicator project, it's really only about $1 billion, or now a little bit more than $1 billion, which in an $800 billion defense budget is kind of a rounding error. So the new team is going to face both the opportunity to scale innovation, but also the challenge. Because in the military, when you spend money on something new, you have to stop spending money on something old. And that's politically one of the most tricky things to do in Washington. And it's tricky because it takes an alignment of a new Secretary of Defense, but also a president willing to take a lot of heat and bring the message to Congress that it's time to change how we're spending. So it takes a real kind of celestial alignment of the planets for that to happen. And so even though the incoming administration has an intellectual direction, they know where they want to go, whether they can pull it off is an open question.
Well, you were also director of strategic planning at the National Security Council. What will you tell the person that's coming in to the Trump administration on the national security side to plan for?
Well, as tragic as Ukraine has been, and frankly, as tragic as the events in the Middle East are, they show us how rapidly the strategic environment is changing. If you would have asked at the Pentagon's holiday party last year, what are the odds that there'd be more than 10,000 North Korean troops on Europe's border? You probably wouldn't have gotten too many takers. You probably also wouldn't have gotten takers a year before that, that Houthi rebels with fairly unsophisticated autonomous weapons and cruise missiles would be able to disrupt shipping in the Red Sea, would be able to take an oil super tanker and light it on fire, risking an environmental catastrophe 10 times the size of the Exxon Valdez. Nor would you have imagined that a modern military like the Israeli Defense Force would be effectively unable to defend its northern border against loitering munitions and cruise missiles, leading 65,000 Israelis having to evacuate from their homes and seek shelter further south. So we're in a remarkable moment that its many parts collectively constitute an emergency, because those collective parts tell us that our existing force structure, our existing military technologies are not able to defend powerfully and muscularly against these new threats, that it's time to change the technology and the operating concepts that we're using to fight.
You didn't mention North Korea. Can we talk about the troops that are now in Ukraine helping Russia?
Yeah, so it's a really extraordinary moment where North Korea has deployed troops on the periphery of Europe. It's the first time in a very long time that North Korean troops have operated outside of North Korea. I mean, we have to go back to the armistice in the 1950s, I think, at the end of the Korean War, where we see North Korean troops operating in this way outside their borders. And so not only is North Korea frequently provocative with their ever-advancing missile, ICBM, and nuclear technology, but now they're actually deploying large formations outside their country. So this is a new and concerning development, one of many around the world that is keeping military strategists up at night.
Painful. Now, I know you work on AI safety. The new national security document that the White House sent out, do you think it's appropriate for AI safety? Do you think it allows innovation but protects the United States?
Well, I think it's important to take a step backwards before we get into the particulars of the executive order and the existing framework that the White House and Congress are using to regulate frontier models. So frontier models, one part of artificial intelligence, but the most advanced part, the part that drives ChatGPT and other large language models. The artificial intelligence community, particularly the researchers that have been working on AI technology for a long time, have known that someday their technology would grow up and be incredibly powerful. And so Elon Musk, Sam Altman, the computer scientist Stuart Russell, have thought ahead and tried to imagine a time when AI technology really could be, say, as powerful as a military system. And that community, to their credit, has raised all kinds of concerns and caution, saying, hey, let's go slow here. Let's be careful that we do this right. But I am not of the view, as are many in that community, that artificial intelligence is, for example, as dangerous as a nuclear weapon. It's been an interesting clash of cultures to watch people in artificial intelligence encounter people who work professionally in national security, who see all kinds of threats, and who might not be as convinced that right now, today, some model somewhere could do something on a scale that a national security strategist would need to be concerned about.
Let's talk about Anthropic. Anthropic is always referred to as more safe. Is it safer than OpenAI?
Well, Anthropic is a company that culturally has prioritized safety to a really remarkable degree. But if you take a step back, Anthropic was, of course, the first to develop a really rigorous framework, a safety framework for how to think about what happens as models get more powerful. But any frontier lab, including OpenAI, including DeepMind and Google, have lots of people in safety and oversight roles that are working hard to make sure the models perform as expected and are there to catch deviations and to withhold models if they are behaving in ways that are unpredictable. From my perspective, I think all of the frontier labs are doing a remarkable job keeping their models safe.
So the U.S. Safety Institute is on the chopping block, according to the Trump platform at the convention. Do you think that's a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, I think there's been so many Hollywood movies, right, that end up with the robots coming to kill us.
Yes, they're coming.
And maybe someday they will come in the far future, right? But right now, I can't even get Siri and my iPhone to set a calendar appointment correctly. So we're a long way, I think, from having to worry about AI posing that level of threat. And so the greater danger is not that AI itself will pose a danger to us, but that we won't experiment with AI in national security applications. And so this is a really important point, I think, to make. The AI safety community, in their enthusiasm to make things perfectly safe, I think have actually prevented an experimentation with the national security community that would have happened earlier. And so I think whoever begins to helm the Department of Defense in this new administration should work very closely and collaboratively with all the frontier labs to put those models to work and see where they can perform a really useful function and to make sure they're deployed in contexts that are safe and not deployed in contexts that those models can't support, that they're not ready for.
So you started the Defense Innovation Unit, Starlink, and Elon Musk has played a big role in Washington and defense tech. What do you think about the role of Elon Musk and of Starlink in U.S. policy?
I think Elon would like it if we called him the X factor in the incoming administration. And he really is. There's an enormous opportunity here, but there are also some risks. And so the opportunity is that Elon, of course, is a savant engineer, somebody who's been able to do things that others simply have not been. And the Ukrainians today are benefiting from the technology that Elon has developed, not only Starlink, but a lot of the autonomy, for instance, that Tesla has developed. These are all the underpinnings of many new systems of drones and other autonomous technology that are being used on the battlefield today. So that's all good. But the complication is that in the past, all of this technology would have come from government labs under government control. But today, because the commercial technology ecosystem, the $25 trillion global consumer market, it's way larger than what's happening in the defense sector. So this goes back to Apple, Google, Tesla, SpaceX having larger market capitalizations than the entire defense industry combined. And what this means is that this incredibly potent technology is being produced and operated entirely in private hands. That's a new thing that the government is going to have to reckon with. When we developed, for instance, the nuclear technology in the Second World War, the Manhattan Project was not run as a private company. It was run as a government function. And today, some of the most potent technology being produced is being developed and run by private companies.
Right. But now that person that's running the private company, one of the most important private companies, is next to the President of the United States on the phone with world leaders. He's obviously a brilliant technologist. What do you think is the best use of Elon Musk's power in this new administration and in government? Or he should just be a leader in his companies and move it along?
Well, Elon is an incredible transformer, right? He's a transformational leader. And so right now, you know, if you look again at the Department of Defense, its most advanced technology initiative, Replicator, is about $1 billion. So less than 1% of the procurement spend of the Pentagon. So you can imagine someone like Elon coming in who understands commercial space, who understands artificial intelligence, who understands modern software development, really being able to help scale innovation inside the Department of Defense for helping the department make the right technology bets. However, this is tricky. The Department of Defense is not a private company. You can't just fire 3/4 of the people that are there and start over. You have to work within the existing system. And where this goes, we're all going to be watching.
That's for sure. The second part of that is the idea that he and Vivek Ramaswamy are putting together a unit in the U.S. government. Do you think they'll do well? Do you think they'll be able to come up with efficiency and savings that would make a difference?
Just as one example, so Defense Innovation Unit, when we arrived in Silicon Valley, we have the same staffing and hiring authorities that anybody in the government has. We can hire civilians, we can hire contractors, but the most we can pay any one of them is, particularly if you're an artificial intelligence engineer, is about a third to one-tenth of what you can make in the private sector. And so if the government model is that you're not willing to pay technologists market rate, you're not going to get any of the good technologists working in the government. Now, if you're a taxpayer, I would want a really great set of technologists working in the government, helping the government figure out which technology to buy. And that problem is still there. We're still at a moment in the middle of this artificial intelligence revolution. We're not at a single department or agency of the government that can actually afford to hire an AI engineer at market rate. They're dependent upon people out of their goodwill coming in, leaving money on the table because they think it's the right thing to do. So anything that the new administration can do to make our government more like other governments, like the government of Singapore, that's able to take technology experts in-house and make better technology decisions would be fantastic. However, you can't break so much glass that the whole system collapses. So this is going to be their challenge.
Well, also, Elon Musk has a point of view with XAI. What do you think of XAI?
Well, XAI right now is 70 engineers that are working 24 hours a day to see if they can come up with a model as competitive as OpenAI or Anthropic or Google DeepMind. And Elon has, of course, the ability to raise money to hire engineers. And so they're an incredible race, but they're starting from behind. Elon started XAI a long time after OpenAI and Anthropic were on the scene and going. So I think the jury is out as to what presence XAI will play.
What do you predict?
Well, I hope they're successful because, again, if you think about as a nation, if you are a national security strategist, what are the advantages that America has that nobody else has? Well, we don't have a great manufacturing base, it turns out. We do a lot of our manufacturing overseas. In fact, China's manufacturing base, our most potentially significant adversary, is larger than our manufacturing base and the Europeans and the rest of our allies combined, right? So that doesn't look good if you're in a shooting war and you're trying to produce materiel. However, if we hold an advantage in frontier models, it could be that our military technology is smarter than our opponents. And to take an iPhone metaphor again, we get a new operating system, thanks to Tim Cook at Apple, every year in our iPhone that is much more powerful than the year before. What if we could drop that kind of advance in artificial intelligence into our military systems? The military AI of this year, or any AI, is going to be way more powerful than the AI of last year. So we're now in a race, going back to the cover of our book, to bring AI into the military in real time so that we don't end up with another F-35 fighter jet that by the time it rolls down the runway, it has computer chips that are almost 20 years too old.
And what about NVIDIA? What do you think of NVIDIA's role in AI and how they're rolling out chips and how they work, not just in the U.S., but around the world? I've met a variety of their folks, and I've tried to get them to tell me, dollars aside, what's the craziest thing someone has offered you to get pushed up the list to get more chips? I can't get them to answer.
It will be interesting to watch. And NVIDIA, really because a quirk of history, because of the processor approach as a company, it set itself up for advanced gaming 10 years ago, now finds itself in the position of producing the fastest AI chips. And right now, the fastest AI chips matter a lot because the models have to have a lot of computational power that drive them. But this won't always be true. Any student of innovation realizes that innovation changes over time. And so competitors to frontier models like OpenAI and Google and Anthropic and XAI are now trying to figure out how they can develop models that are as powerful with less compute, how they can be more efficient with their compute. So again, would I love to have NVIDIA stock in my former government employee portfolio? Yes, I would. But will NVIDIA likely be the top chip maker 10, 15, 20 years from now? Probably not.
It's an incredible story. Like the story you tell in this book that they thought about this, what was it, like 20 years ago? This is the way to go with GPUs. And it took so many years for them to become a hit. It's not like it was one day. And they struggled, just like you guys struggled, to launch this and to make it happen. Chris, what do you think the biggest danger is today?
I think the biggest hurdle that we face is having the right agenda for technology modernization, but having the wrong kind of politics to see it through, in the sense that we're about to embark upon quite the national squabble on a lot of political fronts. And the challenge is in that kind of moment, that kind of political moment, where you could actually get Congress to move a reform agenda through, or whether there's going to be no bandwidth for serious reform at a moment of real political wrangling.
It's very interesting. It's an amazing time. And you're on the front lines of all of this, talking to all of these folks. Will we see in Washington soon? Are you going to come back?
Tammy, it's a pleasure to continue serving, actually, as a public servant. I'm a special government employee with Defense Innovation Unit. I've actually served across multiple presidential administrations in this capacity. And so, yes, you will see me in Washington, where we all have to go every now and then to check in, even though, of course, most of the work goes on the West Coast.
So true. But we met at the Special Competitive Studies Projects AI Expo in May, and it's coming back in June of next year. And I wonder what your take is on this idea that there was the Department of Defense, of course, the Ash-Carter exchange, but also Lucid Cars. You had Senator Schumer and a variety of policy leaders talking about AI. Palantir was a big sponsor, NVIDIA. They were all there. I was moved by the amount of technology that's actually being developed in the U.S. What about you?
Well, this is the culmination of everything we've been working towards. The whole reason why Defense Innovation Unit was started was to access that whole other ecosystem of commercial technology that the government was not, at that time, paying much attention to, and still is only dipping its toes into. I mean, I think less than 1% of the Department of Defense's budget goes to venture-backed firms. And the goal of Defense Innovation Unit was to take these two separate technology ecosystems, the one run by defense companies and then the one run by everybody else, and bring them closer together. And the Special Competitive Studies Project is doing that. And importantly, they're focused on the years 2025 to 2030. And as a strategic planner, I really commend that near-term focus, because the reality is a lot of things, a lot of very problematic things could well happen in our world in that time frame. We don't have, unfortunately, 10 years to figure out how to master and deploy this new set of technology. Our adversaries are already hard at work, as we can see in Ukraine, in the Middle East, in the Red Sea, in China. And so we really have got to go fast and bring the best parts of these technology ecosystems together.
Walter Isaacson calls your book inspiring, a riveting reminder of how hard protecting our nation's security can be and how much depends on the ingenuity of a select few. A must read. It's so great to be with you, Chris. Thank you for this book. Please keep coming back to DC and spending your time and trying to help government, because companies cannot do it alone and government cannot do it alone. Thanks for being with us on the Washington AI Network podcast.
Tammy, thanks for having me.
And good luck at the FT. I'm sure you're going to be Business Book of the Year.
You'll hear a yelp of joy from London. And we will go out for a drink in Washington off the prize money.
There we go. That sounds good. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.